Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
It would be interesting if I was still playing at this moment, how educated I would be, how much I would be able to speak out, because it takes so much of your time to be focused. And that's one thing that this pandemic has maybe helped athletes, because they can take some time to be educated. They can take some time away from their craft. And I think it's, we'll see after it ends, when it comes back for the US Open, if players have a stance, if they're going to wear a Black Lives Matter patch, if they're going to bring it up in their interviews, or if they're going to remain silent and still kind of just let it be done by others, let the Colin Kaepernick speak out and then try to be sort of vanilla and plain and hopefully collect those corporate dollars. So it'll be interesting to see when they come back, who's got a voice. And Naomi has already spoken up, and I love her for that. I love the fact that she's, in my opinion, on the right side of history and fighting for justice for all.
All right, today's a very special day for Jason Knapp, because we got Mr. James Blake in the house. What's up, everybody?
How's it going, Marcus?
We're super, super excited to have you on. So tell us a little bit of story. Where did you grow up? You're an East Coast kid, West Coast kid?
I'm an East Coast kid. I was born in New York, but grew up in Connecticut mostly. I moved to Connecticut when I was about six, and grew up in Fairfield. Used to come back to your neck of the woods, to Harlem, where I first learned to play tennis in the Harlem Junior Tennis Program. So I loved it, and then forever thought I was going to be an East Coaster. Lived almost my whole life there, and you know, as happens often, met a girl, and my wife wanted to be out on the West Coast, and happy wife, happy life. I'm now proud San Diegan and love it. And my kids are growing up here and they're loving it as well. So I'm out on the West Coast now.
Tell us a little bit about your parents. You know, we share something all three. We all had white mothers, and people always ask, how was it to grow up with a white mother? Well, that's the only experience I had. So tell us about that. Share that.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that, because everyone wants to put your experience into something so unique and so special. And just as you said, it's the only way I know. And so it was wonderful. I had a great family. My dad was a disciplinarian. My mom was a little more of the soft touch, but they worked well together. They had a great relationship. And I learned so much from them, because my dad, I mean, they were together, as I'm sure your parents were, in a time when it was very taboo to have a mixed race relationship. And so they were a little more aware than a lot of people probably would have been at that time, because they were attacked. They were vilified for what they were doing. And it really, in my opinion, helped bring out even more love and compassion for my mom, because the people that showed her support were her true friends, were the people that really cared. And she had a white husband first. And she always talks about, I don't understand why people want to vilify the fact that I'm in love with a black man now, when he treats me so much better than my white husband, than my first husband that was white. And so she just saw the love that she had for my dad. And it taught me about loving the person, not the culture, not the skin color, not the religion, not anything. She loved my dad for who he was, not for the color of his skin.
My parents, so we definitely share that kind of ethnic makeup, as far as my dad is African-American, my mom is a white American. And they met in 1966, and they actually ended up moving from the United States because not only because of the difficulties of being an interracial couple, but just of the politics in the United States at the time and where they saw it heading. But also, I think a large factor of that was, one was poverty, but also just the fact of it was really difficult even for their families to accept that they were in love and that they wanted to get married. And did that ever affect, did your parents being an interracial couple ever affect like where they moved or how they spoke to you about, you know, the awareness of who you were and your identity?
Yeah, I mean, I still remember vividly my mom, like almost like the first time I kind of recognized it, because I was blissfully ignorant, as most kids are when you're growing up. Yeah. You kind of want to fit in. But I went to, when I was in Connecticut, I was in about a 95% white school district, and I would go into Harlem to play tennis, where it was about 98% minority. And I felt pretty comfortable in both. Mm-hmm. And then I finally realized that when I was probably about 9 or 10 years old, and someone commented, a white father, happened to be from South Africa, said to my mom, you know, your kid, he's got some talent, you know, maybe he's going to be good, but it's really too bad. It's a shame, you know, for the way he is, because he can be hated by all people. He can be hated by both sides. And without missing a beat, my mom said, you know what? Mm-hmm. I try to look at it the other way. He can be loved by both sides. Mm-hmm. And that's the way that I always felt like my mom believed, and she truly did. And I think your parents' relationship, my parents' relationship, actually becomes stronger because they have to overcome these obstacles. And they knew what they were getting into. They knew the difficulties politically and, you know, in the United States at that time. So I think it taught me a lot about the fact that there's a lot of people that have these negative thoughts, you know, that was the first thought of this man, seeing a 10-year-old kid and thinking about hatred. It taught me that there's a lot of people in this world that think that way. And I need to be able to be okay with that and find a way to try to have compassion the way my mom did, and try to tell him, you know, there's the other side to this.
If you think about the tennis world, you know, Arthur Ashe, on the male side, it was Arthur Ashe. And one of the times, I told Jason this story before, where one of the times when I realized in Sweden that I was completely different was, it was the French Open final. It was Yannick Noah against Mats Wilander. And of course, Mats being Swedish, all the kids were rooting for Mats. And when Yannick won, I was the only one standing up in the room like, yes! And everybody, and I took the beating, but I was like, I was good with it. And that was probably, it was the first time that I really identified, like, I am different, you know? Who were your role models in tennis or, you know, when you were coming up?
Well, Arthur Ashe was a role model, but not necessarily because I got to see him play, which is unfortunate. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, born a little too late. But the reason he was such a role model is because he's the one that got my dad into tennis. He's the reason my father played tennis, seeing Arthur Ashe and wanting to be like him and having him as a role model. So that made him a role model to me. In just being able to learn about him, reading his books, and just learning his stance on education, what he did for fighting apartheid and for human rights, for refugees, for AIDS research. So he was a role model. In tennis, it was a little different for me because I wasn't as much of, I was just a sports fan. I wasn't necessarily just a tennis fan. So I love team sports. I love watching Michael Jordan, love the Giants in football. But in tennis, I didn't pick like necessarily favorites. Actually, Max was one that I really looked up to because I was a hothead when I was a kid. I had a terrible temper. I was a perfectionist. Wow. And seeing Max and seeing how calm he was in every situation, him and Edberg, another Swede, seeing them, I didn't understand how it could be such a tense moment in their matches, and U.S. Open finals, French Open finals, and they could just turn and calmly grab the towel, go and continue playing the match. Like that was something I could dream of being like that calm. And I also love Jim Courier for his work ethic. I kind of picked and chose little things about each player that I really liked. And for Courier is that work ethic, that bulldog mentality. And so I looked up to people like that. I mean, Yannick had the flair. I mean, he loved that. So I would have been, as much as I loved Mats, I would have been right there on the couch, jumping up and down, going crazy for Yannick. Because that, I mean, I got to meet him later. I'm not a big like picture taker. I'm terrible about it. But when I did, as I said, I met my now wife. I met her. She came into my house for the first time, and there were basically no pictures up. But the one that I had up was back when I had my dread.
Yeah, you had your dread.
And I got to hang with Yannick, and I took a picture when he had the dreads, I had the dreads. That was the one picture that was in my room. I mean, the guy was so cool. Everything he touched was turned to gold.
I was just going to say that Stefan Edberg is probably the most Swedish Swede. Like Stefan Edberg, we have another prominent, like legendary athlete named Ingmar Stenmark, who is a skier. Their mood never shifts. Like, you know, they never get excited about anything. It could be in a tight situation, final match. But I remember that because I used to play tennis as a kid, too. And Stefan Edberg was always known as the boring one, you know, but a superb player. But how was it entering the tennis world once you started, you know, once you left Harlem and started playing, I guess, on the entering the competitive circles and circuits?
Yeah, there were plenty of obstacles along the way. I harken back to being still feeling lucky. So I always want to feel optimistic and lucky because of what Arthur Ashe, Althea Gibson, Mal Washington, true trailblazers went through to make it possible. But I still remember when I first played tournaments in New England, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and being held out of the first tournament and then telling me this is just, you know, it's just because it's kind of luck of the draw. It's a lottery. It's your first time. So you're held out of this one. That means you'll definitely get into the next one. And so the next one comes along and they say, no, you're held out of this one too. You didn't get in. And my mom went crazy and bought it and said, he's going to be in. I get in. And the first person I play is the top seed. And I don't know anything. I don't know any of these people. I've never played in a tournament before. I'm 10 years old or something. And I'm playing the top seed. I'm just out there playing. And I beat this kid. Oh, wow. And then moving on, I get to the finals. And the owner of the club that had basically been the one that held me out is there watching until I'm up and about to win. And then leaves and refuses to give me the trophy. Wow. So he's not even there. He left the building. So I remember thinking about these kind of things. At that point, I was still relatively naive. I'm like, oh, maybe he had some place to go. You know, he watched, you know, the whole weekend up until the finals when it comes time to hand out the trophy. And then he leaves because he had something better to do. But it made me realize as I got older that there's going to be some of these hurdles. And then, you know, as I got into the pro ranks and started having success, that's when it became a little more more real. I had a pretty public incident with Leighton Hewitt where he made some racist remarks during a match. And so that was kind of my trial by fire of this huge press conference, huge news about what's going to happen because this happens right at the U.S. Open. And then that's when I kind of make my first splash onto the scene. And it's, you know, because of a racial incident. And that leads to... In fact, the FBI getting involved because my parents start getting death threats at work, and people saying they know where they work, where they live, and you know because it's an interracial couple. At that point, people still were obsessed with that, and it was a little difficult and a little trying at that time. But I knew my parents were standing behind me, and they were unbelievably strong at those times.
Yeah, I have to ask you about that thing because I read about that, and now, you know, as a sports fan, I knew about it. But didn't Leighton say there was something about the referee was black? Well, one of the linesmen were black, and said, "Don't you see the color of his skin?" And so I'm like, think about the privilege. And then we don't have to harp on Leighton. I know you guys made up on this, but it was also an opportunity to learn. I mean, as a black person, you step into this world where the 99% is all white, and you don't think the guy's going to call the ball out because of anything. But when Leighton got pushed, it was such a weak move, you know?
It was. And I still, to this day, think it's crazy because he was arguing about football calls. And so he said that, you know, and he didn't say anything about the color of his skin, but he said, look at him, you tell me what's the same. And it was obviously a black linesman pointing to me. And so it was intimated that it was because of the color of his skin. But I still, to this day, the thing that always baffles me is he's arguing about getting called for footballs when he moves his feet when he serves. So there's no way he can know for sure whether or not he stepped over the line. And I just don't get how you can argue that. If you're arguing a ball that you saw in and they saw out, I mean, we've seen McEnroe do that a million times. That's understandable. But arguing football calls to me seems just shocking. But it just shows that in the heat of the moment, tense situations, people kind of have... whether it's a fear of losing or the competition in general and adrenaline, they're going to explode. And he exploded in a pretty ugly situation. we talked about it. Like you said, we made up, everything was fine. And, you know, we never had an incident after that, but it was, that one was pretty, pretty bad.
I think about that a lot with tennis because it seems in a way as such a lonely, it's a lonely sport. Like it's not a team sport. I'm an artist. So when I'm on stage, when it's time for me to, you know, perform and do my thing, I'm there with a band. Marcus, when you're on the line, you're there with, you know, your sous chefs and you're, you know, part of teams and you obviously have a coach and stuff, but how do you teach yourself to cope with the pressure of it all being on your shoulders when you go out there for a game?
Yeah, that was one of the things that actually drew me to tennis. I love that. I love the feeling of it being all on you. You're at fault if you lose. You're to credit if you win. You go out there, you've got a game plan. You're the one that has to adjust if it's not going well. You're the one that has to sort of problem solve while you're out there. And the pressure is all on you. And I kind of loved that feeling. And that's actually one of the few things. I miss playing, but I don't miss the lifestyle. I don't really miss tennis, the being out on tour as much. But I do miss that pressure, that feeling of it's break point and I want to succeed. I put in all the work. And I don't think I would like it if I didn't feel prepared. That was always the key for me, is if I felt prepared, I know I put in the thousands and thousands of hours to practice for this. So I'm ready for this situation. I love that feeling.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Do you think activism and sport, right? Right now, you see the Premier League, people have taken a knee. And of course, Colin Kaepernick started the second movement after, you know, really thinking about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Arthur Ashe and the generation Muhammad Ali. Do you, and in many ways, I think Venus and Serena on the women's side and Richard, which is the father, how do you think Black Lives Matter lives within tennis? Or does it?
Well, I think, yeah, Venus and Serena have made a huge impact. You see it already in women's tennis in America with Madison Keys, Sloane Stephens, Coco Gauff, Hayley Baptiste. You've got so many that are following in the footsteps of Venus and Serena that it's really inspiring to see.
Don't sleep on Naomi. I just cooked with her last week. Don't sleep on Naomi.
I was thinking, you're right. I was thinking about the Americans. I mean, she's been living in America, and it's, you know, we would love to adopt her as American. Yeah. But she's been a powerful voice as well in this moment. And so it's really great to see and encouraging. On the men's side, you got Francis Tiafoe. But it's a little different because of how individual it is. You're not a part of a team where, like you said, in Premier League, they can all kneel. In the NBA, you're seeing teams get together. In the Major League Baseball, you're seeing teams get together and make this decision. For tennis players, it's really interesting at this moment because it's an individual decision. You're your own small business. Someone larger than small businesses like Naomi. But you're your own business, so you have to make these decisions. And I always have to defer to the players to make their decision for themselves. I would love to see some of the players speak out as much as they feel comfortable. Coco Gauff has already spoken out, which I think is incredible for a 16-year-old to be able to be as poised as she is and speaking out and still focus on the tennis. Because I know for me to be successful, I had to be so almost isolated and in a bubble and focused on tennis and on my sport to be successful, because I maybe didn't have the same talent as the Roger Federer or the Murat Safin, the guys that were so naturally gifted. So I felt like I needed to be so focused on it that it would be interesting if I was still playing at this moment, how educated I would be, how much I would be able to speak out, because it takes so much of your time to be focused. And that's one thing that this pandemic has maybe helped athletes, because they can take some time to be educated. They can take some time away from their craft. And I think it's, we'll see after it ends, when it comes back for the US Open, if players have a stance, if they're going to wear a Black Lives Matter patch, if they're going to bring it up in their interviews, or if they're going to remain silent and still kind of just let it be done by others, let the Colin Kaepernick speak out and them try to be sort of vanilla and plain and hopefully collect those corporate dollars. So it'll be interesting to see when they come back, who's got a voice. And Naomi has already spoken up, and I love her for that. I love the fact that she's, in my opinion, on the right side of history and fighting for justice for all.
I'm thinking, like, as opposed to the music world, it seems like you look at what happened to Colin Kaepernick, but also what happened to, you know, Tommy Smith in 1968, raising his, you know, the Black Power salute while receiving the gold medal, like the blowback for athletes and like losing sponsorships or being excluded from leagues with Colin not being, he was excluded from the NFL and not given a new job.
Well, I'm sitting here in my little office here looking at a picture of Tommy Smith and John Carlos. Mm. I think a lot of people forget that, you know, Tommy Smith, they talk about Tommy Smith and John Carlos as heroes, and they forget that the next day they were sent home by the Olympic Committee. They were vilified. Pretty much blackballed by U.S. track and field for quite a while, until now. They, at a time in history now, people regard them as heroes. But at the time, they were in hiding, practically.
That's what I mean. The cost for athletes is really high. And like you say, you're your own business, and you know, this is your income and what you've trained your entire life to be able to do. It's a lot at stake. Whereas for artists, sure, there are things at stake too, but it's actually, activism is usually just it's, you know, you're communicating the same thing that your fans are already feeling.
Yeah, and for athletes, there are huge stakes, so that's why I try to be careful to criticize them, because it's their own decision, and they're making decisions for their livelihood, to support their families, and for what's important to them. And that's why I also think that people speaking out just to speak out doesn't make sense. If you have a passion, if you feel a certain way about something, then speak out, whether I agree with it or disagree with it. I respect your right to speak out about it. And there are plenty in tennis that definitely disagree with my point of view, and I respect them for speaking out. I would love to actually talk to them and calmly, and have a conversation that shows why they came from. I think a lot of conversations that happen just are going around the issues and not getting to the why. One thing that very rarely happens is, why do you feel that way? Why do you feel that, you know, the inequality gap continues to grow in America? Why do you feel that it's okay to have racist policies that are continuing to be in effect that make it that marginalize the Black community? What, you know, why is that okay? And you start getting to like why, you know, where they came from and what they feel, and they're, you know, okay, well, it's all about hard work, and you know, anyone has the American dream, and not realizing that they've never been around a Black community that's been where the public education there doesn't give them a fair chance because of the property taxes, because of the laws that make it so that they're going to get less funding and not have the same kind of schools that there are in a white community. So there's a lot of things that I think people would love to, that I would love to talk to them about, but I respect all of them for speaking out.
But James, one thing that I really admire with you is that every time it's a heated moment, your book talks about grace, but you have grace. And one time when you really got tested is in, you know, 2015 in the city that we love here in New York City. You got basically football tackled in front of your hotel. Tell us about what happened, and did the police officer ever apologize to you? Like, tell us about that situation.
Yeah, it was surreal. I was just waiting to go to the U.S. Open to do an appearance. I was I'd retired a couple of years earlier, so I was just doing some corporate events and waiting. I'd just flown in that morning on a red eye, waiting for a car to pick me up. And I look up and I see someone running at me. And if you see the video that's been, you know, out there everywhere, I'm actually smiling because I think I'm in New York, the U.S. Open. I just got there. This is some fan running up to tell me I saw the Agassi match. This guy's running at me, and I think it's kind of strange, but then, I mean, in a split second, he pins me against the wall, throws me on the ground, and puts his knee in my back and, you know, cuffs me, and I don't even know what to do, but, you know, I don't know if you had the conversation with your dad as well, but for me, I remember back to the conversations I had with my dad, and I said, I'm doing whatever you say, I'm complying 100%. No, assuming this is an officer, even though he never said that he was an officer, I just assumed he's cuffing me, and in broad daylight in the middle of New York City, I assume this has got to be an officer. And then he never apologized. After about 10 minutes of having me in custody, never really explaining much, eventually telling me they were looking for someone that was operating a credit card fraud scheme. And then someone realized that it wasn't me. I think they must have Googled, and they looked at because they were looking at the phone and looking at me. And but no, they never apologized. His only comment to me at the end was, just so you know, the person we're looking for is still in the area. That had nothing to do with me. I didn't care. But then it ended up, as I talked about in my book, it turned me into sort of an accidental activist. It made me realize that this happens far too often. And I wanted to brush it under the table. I wanted to, you know, tell my wife and say, you know, I'm not going to say anything. I don't want to do anything. And she said, well, what if it happened to me? What if it happened to somebody you love? You know, and I thought, okay, there's too many people this happens to that aren't able to go on Good Morning America tomorrow to talk about it. And then, so that's what I did. I went and started talking about it. I tried to do something positive with it. I created a fellowship for people that happens to have legal assistance, because most people, I feel like you said, I feel like I'm calm and cool under pressure. And in that situation, I was still so in shock, so vulnerable, that I didn't think to get their badge numbers, their names, their precinct, anything like that.
Yeah.
Only because I was able to go to the media and have afford a lawyer. That's why I was able to get all that information and find that out. But most people will be off to their 9-to-5 job from there and never get any sort of closure on that situation. They would just be done. So for me, I felt like I needed to speak out for all those people that wouldn't have that. And so I did what I could to, when I get an audience with Mayor de Blasio and Police Chief Bill Bratton, I'm going to try to use it for something positive instead of just trying to sue the New York City and, you know, increase my, my income. I'm not looking to do that. I want to do something that's going to help. And the other thing I wanted to do is increase the accountability. So I fought for over two years to try to get some sort of justice for this officer who, this was his fifth offense. Of something like this, of excessive force, and one of them including breaking a guy's jaw, all African-American men. And so I tried so hard and tried to say this is a precedent-breaking case, but all they could do was he lost 5 vacation days.
And is it true that he actually tried to sue you, or actually sued you? That's what I heard, yeah.
Yeah, he tried to sue me. He tried to sue my book publisher. He tried to sue the city of New York, the New York Police Department, and the Civilian Complaint Review Board. He tried to sue all of us. They were all thrown out.
It just makes you think, how do you get to this disconnect between law enforcement and the people they aim to protect and serve? With, there's not that self-consciousness of, oh, okay, I've actually crossed a boundary or stepped across a line here. I was actually in the wrong. I mean, hearing that he tried to sue you is just mind-blowing.
Yeah, and he's backed up by the police unions. The police unions, that's one thing that's a huge macro issue. That's a big problem, I think, is these police unions are so strong. They're going to back him up. And even if he had been fired by NYPD, there's a good chance Miami PD, Chicago PD, LA, someone else is going to pick him up and hire him, because these unions are so strong that they hide those records. They don't want people to know when they have other excessive force violations and things like that and misconduct. And they are going to fight on his behalf no matter what. And so for this, the loss of five vacation days to me is a slap on the wrist, almost saying, go out and do it again. You know, was public on camera again, you know, with a public figure. So what's to stop him from next time it's 2 a.m. in a back alley? Does he think he's really going to get punished if he beats someone up even worse? It just doesn't, to me, it seems like it's so counterproductive to give someone that's got lethal force, they've got this much power, you need to be able to hold them accountable when they make tragic mistakes.
So fast forward to today, what is your activism look like today with everything that's going on in the wake of George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor?
Well, I'm just encouraged now because, I mean, I've been screaming about this for the last 5 years, and now, and the Black and Brown community has been screaming about this for the last decades, you know, five decades about police brutality. And Colin Kaepernick brought much more attention to it just a few years ago at great personal expense. But now the fact that it's growing and the majority is actually listening after the George Floyd incident, I'm extremely encouraged. For me, I wrote a book about it, but I'm also just encouraged to see athletes speaking up. I don't have the same platform I used to have, you know, when I was, you know, hitting the balls, hitting my forehand pretty well. Now it's just speaking out when I can. I love the fact that you guys are talking about it, and these kind of forums are my platform now. And so I thank you for having me. But now it's just getting people. One of the biggest things is these protests have actually had impact immediately. They're trying to repeal 50A in New York, which is what shields the police records. They're creating Breonna's Law in Kentucky for the no-knock warrants. They're trying to get a national chokehold ban. These protests are having effects immediately, and I try to encourage people that the next best thing to protesting, to having an effect, is voting. Vote for people that are actually going to have your rights in mind, because for too long, we have people that just want the status quo. And the status quo for the Black and Brown community is not good. It's not something where there's fairness, there's not equality, there continues to be police brutality, there continues to be too many policies that are making us feel like second-class citizens. So vote for people that are going to have those interests at heart, and not just the people that want to keep the status quo and keep their jobs and keep the lobbyists employed. And so it's that's the next step is November.
My very, very last question we have here is, because I know you got to go, but our last question is, hip-hop turned 47 this week. And I always wanted to know, when you were working out or when you were traveling, because just like Jason said, you're in your own space, what was in the headphones? What were you listening to during your time coming up?
So the one song that they give you the choice of what you can play when you come out of the U.S. Open, and the one song I always had to have, Juicy by Biggie.
Oh, there you go.
The best one.
Yeah, yeah. that's stepping out with swag. Yeah.
I was a huge fan of Biggie. I mean, I love Tupac as well. Biggie was the greatest to me. So I was a big fan of that. Now it's, you know, come further with the Jay-Z. I like listening to him. And yeah, hip hop being 47 is crazy. I mean, nowadays I love the if you're doing Pandora or whatever, just the 90s rap.
Yeah,
like, you can't get a bad song on there. No. Go back to the hip hop station. So I love it.
I love the fact that I think it's your daughter. It's like pulling your
little hand there. Yeah. No. It's time to go.
We gotta go.
I think she wants waffles.
Yeah.
Waffles.
All right.
Waffles. The daddy's the waffle maker.
James, thank you so much for talking to us, man.
My pleasure. Thank you guys so much. Marcus, keep running too. I gotta still try to catch you.
Yeah, this guy is fast.
It's incredible, man. I can't even come close.
Thank you. Be good, guys. We'll talk soon.
All right. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
But James, man, there was so much more I was about to get into with the white mother thing, but we're going to continue on that because, you know, it made me think that for me, the person who really got most angry, like I'd come home and tell them about some racist shit that happened, was always my mom. She was the one who was like, it can't be like this. My dad was more like, this is how it is. All right. So what you got to do is you got to learn that when this and this happens, this is the moves you make. But my mom was like, no, God damn it. I'm going to go and talk to them about it, you know. And that, I, you know, like James' mom, your mom, my mom is really, you know, it gives me hope to see that, yes, a post-racial society, you know, would be possible, at least on the individual level, is possible because I know white people like my mother, you know. I know white people like your mom. And I was just thinking about that because what I could glean from what he was saying, that his mom really stood up for him in tight situations. Whereas I imagine his dad being kind of like my dad, like, hey, well, this is no surprise. This is, you know, what we have to be prepared for. This is, you know, this is how it is.
Did your mom ever, when they used to call you the N-word, which they did with me, right? My mom's comeback was never strong enough. Like, my mom's comeback was always like, if they call you something, she would say, we'll call them white cookie. And I'm like,
That's not bad.
My mom was like, because what, like, the main bully at my school had freckles. So she said, you know, you could call them, you know, your skin color is beautiful. Theirs is not at all as beautiful. You can call them salami face or you could call them maggots. You have the skin color of maggots. But see, and I did. I ran back and I, you know, next day in school, that's what I was saying. But it never had the same effect on them. What happened was that my mom actually, because I didn't tell my mom about that I was being bullied every day by the same gang of boys. And they were calling me the N-word in different variations. And then I told her about it. She said, go back, call them these names. And, you know, I did. And my mom actually called the teacher later. And the teacher said, well, yeah, they've been calling Jason names, but Jason has been calling them names too. So the teacher chose to set it at their, you know, even playing field. My mom's just like, yeah, whatever. That my bullying didn't stop until Paul Burton and Ariel Gomar, who were 1 year older, you know, a black guy and a Latino guy that came down from seventh grade to sixth grade and told the boys that were bullying me, because they had found out about it, that if you ever do that again, you'll have to answer to us. And that day, I never heard the N-word again at my school.
Well, you know, it's interesting how those things, you know, my mom always threatened by, do you want me to come with you to school? And I was like, absolutely not. So I was like, the choice was, I'd rather take it than have my mom step into school, you know?
Yeah. There's something in it, I think, that for a person with white skin who really and truly doesn't believe in a racist structure or racist hierarchy, to be confronted with that racism exists, it kind of... That's what I think emboldens, you know, people like my mom, your mom, to want to just go straight to the authority and tell them, hey, what's this? We can't have this. This is unacceptable, you know. Whereas for black and brown people who over so many generations, we know that this is a fact of life. We may be much more hesitant and careful about, like, calling the headmaster, the principal at school, or, you know, going straight up to the office and banging your fist on the desk. You know, it reminds me of that to truly tear down the racist mindset to begin with, it has to be done by the awakening of white people. You know, because just like James was saying, black and brown people have been talking about this for decades. It truly needs to be white people talking about it and actively doing things about it for change to come about.
Jason, truly, like if you boil it down, because as a black and brown person, you assume whatever you're stepping into, it's a mixed room. There's going to be white people, there's going to be Asians, there's going to be Latinos, there's going to be blacks, whatever. You just assume, you never assume really. So what is it? What is the, I always try to figure out, and I thought about this forever and never figured it out. What is the fear? Like, we're not going to come back for revenge. That's not happening. We just want some basic things, like send our kids to school, great access to education.
It's like Kimberly said, you know, white people should be happy. All we want is equality and not revenge, you know? It was never about that. Marcus, always a pleasure. It was a beautiful conversation with James and all our listeners out there. Thanks for keeping up with this moment, and we'll catch you again next week.
Peace.
This moment is produced by Mohammed El Abed. It's an Acast recording and can be heard on all platforms. So stay tuned. More depth coming your way soon.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.